Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Hanging Hannah by Evan Marshall, narrated by Tanya Eby. Though he slay me, yet I will trust in him. Job, chapter 13, verse 15. 1. There were marigolds in her salad, bright spiky orange petals among the radicchio. With a groan of disgust, Jane pushed the plate away. Across the table, Bertha looked up from her own identical salad, crunching with gusto on a mouthful of greens. "You don't like it?" she asked, eyes wide with concern. "No," Jane said petulantly, "and I don't like this restaurant either." Why had she agreed to have lunch here? The establishment, called Dig, was, in Jane's opinion, one of the most pretentious of New York's expense account lunch spots. Faux archaeological finds that looked like gargantuan stone bowls hung by massive chains from the ceiling of the cavernous room. There happened to be one of these bowls directly over Jane's head, and every so often she cast a wary glance upward at its grimy bottom, wondering how much it weighed. A ton? Two? "I'm sorry, Jane," Bertha said. "I should have suggested something more down to earth. Maybe Smith and Walensky, or Gallagher's." Jane forced a smile and shrugged. Where they ate, she realized, didn't really matter. It was self-centered Bertha she disliked more than she could dislike any restaurant. But Bertha was one of the most successful clients of Jane's literary agency, a writer of historical romances beloved by hundreds of thousands. And once in a while, Jane was obliged to lunch with her because, unfortunately, Bertha lived here in New York City, no more than 25 miles east of Shady Hills, the village in northern New Jersey where Jane lived and worked. Bertha was a pouter. That was what Jane disliked about her most. In fact, Bertha was pouting now, her lower lip pushed out like a child's, her pale blue eyes sullenly downcast. With her index finger, she played with a lock of her badly dyed yellow hair, a yellow, Jane realized, that was uncannily close to that of the marigolds in their salads. "Jane," Bertha said, "have I done something to offend you?" "Offend me?" Jane feigned horror. "No, Bertha, of course not. I just don't like you." "What makes you ask that?" "You're not yourself today." "Oh yeah? Who am I?" Bertha looked impatient. "Come on, Jane. We've been working together too long for you not to be honest with me. We're friends." "What's wrong?" Yes, they'd been working together a long time, 4 years, and for the commissions she earned on Bertha's novels, written under the famous pseudonym of Rhonda Redmond, Jane was grateful. But Jane rarely allowed herself to become true friends with her clients. She'd tried that once, had become far more than just friends with one of her clients, and the result had been disastrous. Besides, Jane wasn't sure herself what was making her so grouchy, other than having to take Bertha to lunch. "Is it that you have a birthday coming up?" Bertha asked in a coy voice, watching Jane obliquely. Jane looked at her sharply. "How did you know that?" "I've always known your birthday. Don't you remember? When I first met you, I asked you your astrological sign and you told me your birthday." "Oh, right." Yet another reason she disliked Bertha, who had made Jane's astrological sign an important criterion in her decision as to whether to hire Jane. Thank heavens Jane's moon had been in the seventh house, or whatever had happened to be right for Bertha to sign on. But despite her irritating qualities, Bertha was perceptive, and she was right. Jane had been feeling depressed at the thought of her upcoming 39th birthday. "It's May 26th, right?" Bertha said. "Right. Bertha nodded as if suddenly understanding everything. "You're already lonely without Kenneth, and this is an especially bad time for you in that respect."
"What respect?"
"Being with people. Your natural tendency right now is to avoid people, to be reclusive, but you have to fight that tendency."
"Or else what?"
"Or else stay lonely."
"Bertha,"
Jane said with exasperation, "I haven't the slightest idea what you're talking about." But to herself, she admitted Bertha was right. She was lonelier these days than she could ever remember feeling in the 2.5 years since Kenneth's death. She had told herself that time would make the loss easier to bear, but it had done the exact opposite. The longer he was gone, the more she missed him. He had, after all, been not only her husband, the father of Nicholas, but also her business partner, the other and principal literary agent at the Kenneth Stewart Agency. Thus, he had been the person with whom she'd spent nearly all of her time.
There would never be another Kenneth. Of that she had been bitterly reminded half a year ago, when she had hoped to take an intimate friendship with one of her clients to an even more intimate level. In the end, she had lost him as both a friend and a client, and realized how faulty her judgment could be. The waiter approached their table.
"Are you ladies finished with your salads?"
"Quite," Jane said, watching him take Bertha's empty plate. He frowned down at Jane's salad, barely touched.
"You didn't care for it?"
"I like to keep my flowers in the garden, thanks," Jane said. But the young man didn't hear her, because he had already stepped away to take plates off a tray held by a white-aproned young woman who had followed him from the kitchen.
"Now then," the young man said, placing a plate before Bertha. "For you, we have the warm buffalo calzone with eggplant chutney."
Bertha smiled and eyed the plate eagerly, like a child. "Yum." "And for the other lady, the free-range chicken with the yucca frittata." "Ooh, doesn't that look nice?" Bertha commented, leaning forward to study Jane's plate. "Jane, you must try this buffalo. It's simply heavenly. Have you ever had it?" Jane had, once. It had tasted like liver. "No thanks," she told Bertha with a smile, and cut into her chicken. She'd figured there wasn't much they could do to chicken. As for the yucca frittata, she had no intention of even touching it. With her knife, she pushed it to the extreme edge of her plate. When Jane looked up, Bertha was watching disapprovingly. "No sense of adventure." "What do you mean, no sense of adventure? This chicken is free range." Bertha shrugged. "All that means is that it was allowed to forage." "And eat bugs and worms," Jane thought. "My goodness," she told herself, "I am in a bad way." Maybe Bertha was right. Maybe the cure for her funk was to do something new, get out more, see people. "You know, I've been thinking," Bertha said, cutting her buffalo. "Good," Jane thought. "Keep it up and maybe someday you'll be a decent writer." Then she felt ashamed at such a mean thought and made an effort to listen to Bertha. "This year," Bertha said, "the annual convention of romance authors together is in New York City, June 17th through 19th, Thursday through Saturday. Why don't you come, circulate, maybe give a workshop?" "A workshop? About what?" "Since it is a romance convention, what about romance?" This was Bertha being sarcastic. "What about it?" "I don't know, Jane. Think of something. What your agency is looking for, the qualities you look for in the books you take on, what constitutes the perfect client." Bertha threw back her head and laughed. "You and I should give that one together." Jane would have laughed too, but there was a very good possibility Bertha was serious. Could she actually consider herself the perfect client? "Nah," Jane said. "I'm not a convention person. Can't stand people swarming around me. And some of those romance writers, you know how catty and backbiting they can be." Bertha seemed to take her remark as a personal affront. She looked on the verge of pouting again. "Present company excluded, of course." "Of course." "Oh, come on, Jane." Now Bertha was absolutely pleading. "It would be so good for you. A workshop is about 50 minutes long, with 10 minutes for question and answer. An hour. What's the big deal?" Jane had to smile. "You've been put up to this, haven't you? Someone asked you to recruit me?" Bertha seemed about to protest, then to decide it was no use. She looked down, abashed. "Yes," she whispered. Then she seemed to fill with new courage. "You should be flattered. The people on the board really want you, Jane. You have no idea what an excellent reputation you have. Besides, after that piece and people, not that again." 2 months ago, the magazine had finally run its profile of Jane and her fellow inhabitants of Shady Hills, where last fall, Jane, with the help of her tortoiseshell cat, Winky, had solved the mystery of Jane's missing nanny, Marlene. Bertha had bent over to rummage around in her bag and now sat up brandishing the magazine, folded to display a half-page photo of Jane sitting on her sofa with her assistant, Daniel, and his fiancée, Laura. Above the photo ran a headline in bold capital letters, "Agent of Justice," and below it, "Book peddler Jane Stewart is North Jersey's Miss Marple." Jane rolled her eyes. The notion of being profiled in the magazine had sounded fun at first, and the whole village had gotten into the act. On the following page was a shot of hundreds of Shady Hills residents, all in matching detective-style trench coats, standing in a huge cluster on the green, the white Victorian bandstand behind them. But now the idea of making her search for Marlene, the subject of one of the magazine's lighthearted human interest pieces, seemed obscene to Jane, and she inwardly cringed whenever she thought of it. Bertha giggled. I still can't believe it. You can't buy this kind of publicity. Anyone who didn't know who you were certainly knows now. You owe it to yourself to cash in on this exposure. I don't want exposure, Jane said. I want clients. That's what I'm trying to tell you. People who are considering approaching you to represent them will have a chance to meet you at the RAT convention. It's the largest writers' convention in the country. Think of the possibilities. It was true that Jane needed more clients. Her roster of mostly B-level writers of genre novels barely provided her with a living and allowed her to pay Daniel and Florence, her son Nick's nanny. Jane realized now that she'd known she would eventually have to get out there and beat the bushes for new business. She supposed this was as good a time as any. A better time than any, if Bertha was right. But Jane did hate these things. She sat pondering for a moment while Bertha watched her, eyes wide. All right, Jane said at last, but on one condition. That Daniel present my workshop with me. I'm sure that's fine, Bertha said. She smiled suggestively, wiggling her eyebrows. He's dreamy. He's also half your age, Bertha Stumpf. Age. Bertha dismissed the whole issue with a flip of her chubby hand. I'm surprised you didn't point out that he's African-American. I think age matters more. But it's a moot point because he's engaged to a Caucasian woman. Jane. Bertha leaned forward, her tone that of a parent trying to be patient while lecturing a child. Love is love. Love is the answer. C'est l'amour. Love knows no color or age. Love doesn't even know time. Oh, brother. Jane remembered that Bertha's last novel had been a time travel romance. Jane felt a wave of nausea coming on. Bertha was quickly sliding into Rhonda Redmond mode. Was it too soon to leave? Speaking of love, Bertha leaned even farther forward, eyebrows rising. Who knows who you might meet at the convention? Jane looked at her aghast. You mean a man? At the RAT convention? Why not? There are male romance writers, you know. And some of your fellow speakers are eligible male agents and editors. It's just one more reason you should attend. I've already said I would. I know, Bertha said, as if deciding to let up on Jane. Now, she said briskly, I'll need a brief bio on both you and Daniel, and also a nice photo of each of you for the convention program booklet. Oh, and a line or two describing your workshop. Jane, who was fully aware of her own absent-mindedness, pulled a small notebook from her purse and jotted these things down. As their waiter appeared to remove their plates and take their coffee order, Bertha changed the subject to the plot of her current romance. A vintage Rhonda Redmond about a prim English heiress who was separated from her party during a tour of the Sahara and found wandering half-dazed by a darkly dangerous sheik. Bertha was calling it Casbah. It was a good 45 minutes before Jane felt comfortable looking at her watch and exclaiming that she'd better get back to the office. Outside on the sidewalk, Bertha gave Jane a hug. Happy birthday. Now, don't forget those things I need. And thanks for lunch, sweetie. We really must do it more often. Sweetie? Jane forced a big smile and waved as she backed towards 7th Avenue, where she would hail a cab that would take her to the Port Authority bus terminal and her bus to New Jersey. At the corner of 48th and 7th, she turned her head sharply when she passed a man for who an instant she thought was Kenneth. Like Kenneth, he was tall and lanky, with sandy hair and light green eyes. She almost called out to him before catching herself. It wasn't the first time that had happened. Bertha was right. Jane needed a man in her life. Well, Jane reflected, at least she wouldn't have to see Bertha again until the RAT convention, which Jane was already regretting having agreed to. Beyond that, who knew when she would have to see Bertha again? Lunch with Bertha Stumpf was like jury duty. Get it over with and you're left alone for 2 years. Laughing at this thought, Jane stepped off the curb at 7th Avenue and hailed a passing cab. At the Port Authority, she started for her bus's gate, then realized she was starving and veered toward a snack bar for a slice of pizza. At the precise moment Jane entered the office, Daniel uttered a curse she had never heard him utter before. Hearing her come in, he turned to her from his computer, a sheepish smile on his handsome coffee-colored face. Sorry, I'm having trouble with this database. Recently, Jane had bought a software program created specifically for literary agencies, and it had fallen to Daniel, whose knowledge of computers far surpassed Jane's, to supervise the entering of client and deal data into the program's database. Jane plopped her bag on his desk and sat down in his visitor's chair. What's the problem?
The problem is me. Instead of pressing tab after entering information in a field, I keep pressing enter, which saves the record and takes me to a fresh record.
I haven't the slightest idea what you're talking about. Maybe we should just forget the whole thing. He frowned at her as if she were crazy.
We paid a fortune for this program.
He nodded with assurance.
We'll get it right. It's just a matter of getting used to it.
He was right. They had paid a fortune for it. And every time Jane thought about that, she felt a pang of money anxiety that tied her stomach in knots and kept her awake nights. But the representative from the software company had convinced her and Daniel that in the long run, the software would save them money.
More than pay for itself, as he had put it.
So, trying to think like Kenneth, who had always been up for a risk, Jane had said yes and invested in the program. Daniel had turned back to the computer and was typing something. He pressed enter and immediately slammed his hand down on his knee.
Damn, I did it again.
Why not take a break? Jane suggested. How did the morning go? He swiveled away from the computer, his composure returning.
Pretty well. Quiet. Oh, Angela Knightinson called. She has some questions about her Harper contract.
He referred to a small pile of pink slips on his desk.
Agnes Enright at Fawcett says it's too late to change the back cover copy on Joanna Fairman's mystery.
What? Joanna's going to be livid. That copy gives away the whole solution.
He gave her an indulgent smile. Now, Jane, it doesn't really.
Yes, it does. The caretaker did it, and the copy describes him as sinister. Daniel opened his mouth to speak, then seemed to think better of it, and instead just shrugged.
It's too late.
She blew out her breath. You know, sometimes I would like to march into these editors' offices and wring their necks. How the hell would they like it if someone just whipped out the cover copy for their books as if it mattered as much as a shopping list?
My, my, Daniel said, pulling back in surprise. And what kind of a day have you been having?
What kind do you think? I was having lunch with Bertha.
Was it that bad?
You know I can barely stand her simpering face. But it gets worse. How should she tell him? She smiled her little girl smile. Daniel?
Uh-oh.
Please don't be mad at me.
Mad at you?
He frowned in puzzlement.
What have you done?
I volunteered you.
Volunteered me? For what?
Bertha begged me. The steering committee, or whatever it's called, put her up to asking me.
To do what?
She winced and forced the words out fast. To present a workshop at the Rat Convention?
The Rat Convention? But you hate conventions, and you hate giving workshops even more.
That's true, she said reasonably. But I agreed to it on one condition. He sat back in his chair and exhaled in tired resignation.
Me?
Yes, she said meekly. Please don't be angry. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have done it. But Bertha begged me and said it would be good for the agency, especially after the People article. I knew she was right, that I should do it, but I didn't want to do it alone. You know how nervous I get speaking in public. He smiled understandingly.
I'm not angry. I do know how scared you get, though I've never understood it. You're certainly not shy one-on-one.
No, that's true, she said thoughtfully. But it's a proven fact that some people fear public speaking more than they fear death.
I see. Well, even without the statistic, I'm not mad. I know how hard it must have been for you to agree. I'm happy to help. What is our workshop about, if I may ask?
I thought about it on the bus. How about the changing face of romance?
He shrugged. We can do that.
She rose happily. Thanks, really. Guess I better return those calls. She started for her office.
Jane?
She turned.
Is something else bothering you?
What do you mean?
You seem down.
X-ray vision, she said, pointing at him. I am down. It's silly, though. It's my birthday a week from Wednesday.
That's not silly at all.
She cheered slightly that at 26, he could understand this. You don't think so? After all, in 9 days, I'll be turning 39. He frowned slightly.
I understand being a little depressed at growing older, but does 39 have some special significance?
Of course. It's 1 year from 40.
Ah.
He gave this some thought, then brightened.
Look at it this way. Kenneth was 40 when he met you. You see? That's proof positive that wonderful things can happen even at that advanced age.
He was right. She had met Kenneth when he was 40. Suddenly, not for the first time, she could envision Kenneth emerging from the office at the far end of the reception room, a room she and Daniel now used for storage. In her vision, he was giving her that huge white smile he had used so freely. He was as handsome as he'd been the last time she'd seen him, the day he'd left for a meeting in New York City, only to emerge from the Simon & Schuster building, step off the curb, and get killed by a careless truck driver. She fought down the lump growing in her throat.
Jane, Daniel said, sitting up, I'm so sorry. That was thoughtless of me. I didn't mean to make things worse.
I know, she smiled. It's not you, and I've already got a plan for dealing with this 39 problem.
Oh?
I'm going to do like Jack Benny and stay 39 forever.
That works.
She laughed and walked into her office, throwing her bag onto the top of the work heaped sloppily on her desk. She realized that the image of Kenneth was still with her. She sat at her desk and looked at the phone, thinking of the calls she had to make to Angela Knightinson and Joanna Fairman. She had a better idea. She'd call Nick. He'd be home from school by now. She punched out her home number. Florence answered in her lilting Trinidadian tones.
Ah, Mrs., and how has your day been going?
As well as can be expected, Florence. Is Nick there?
He sure is, sitting right here having yodels and milk. Hold on.
Jane made a mental note to speak to Florence about giving Nick fruit for his after-school snacks.
Hi, Mom.
Jane felt her face break into a smile. Hello, darling. I love you.
What? Why are you saying that?
Aren't mothers allowed to say that to almost 10-year-olds? Nick had a birthday coming up, too, 3 days before hers.
Mom, Nick said impatiently, why did you call?
Aside from telling you I love you, to ask how your day is going.
Fine, he said. Can I go now? Aaron will be here in a minute, and I promised I'd have my army men set up when he got here.
Okay, I'll talk to you later. She hung up, feeling better. Nick always made her feel better. He was all she had left of Kenneth. If only Kenneth had lived to see Nick now, he'd have been so proud. In 6 days, Nick would be 10, only 3 years from being a teenager. Jane supposed she would have thoughts like this at various times throughout her life. When Nick graduated from college, when he got married, when his first child was born. And perhaps by then, the pain would have lessened. But now that pain was still raw. She glanced at the photo of her and Kenneth and Nick on her credenza, the picture of the three of them in life jackets in Cape May. Had Kenneth known how much she loved him? If she could just be sure that he had, perhaps it wouldn't hurt so bad. With a deep sigh, she reached for the phone again, finally ready to call her clients. 2. Was there anything as relaxing as knitting? Jane wondered, ensconced on one of the green and gold tapestry print sofas in the living room of Hydrangea House. She yanked some more yarn out of the bag at her feet, then let her hands fly as she surveyed her friends, fellow members of the Defarge Club, sitting about her. Next to Jane on the sofa sat Ginny Williams, her pixie-ish face scrunched up while she tried to untangle a network of different colored yarns that traversed the back of the sweater she was knitting for Rob, her longtime boyfriend. Jane had lost count of the number of times she had tried to convince Ginny, a neophyte knitter, to attempt something simpler than this complicated sweater pattern she'd selected. More importantly, Jane had recently begun to try to convince Ginny that perhaps her relationship with Rob was never going to work out the way Ginny wanted it to. Ginny wanted desperately to get married, to have children. Rob, though basically a decent man, was ethereal and free-spirited. Not surprising in an artist. He designed silver jewelry. And even after 5 years of living with Ginny, he refused to make the move from boyfriend to fiancé. Jane saw Ginny frequently, more than she saw any of the other members of the Defarge Club, because Ginny worked as a waitress at Whipped Cream, the cozy cafe across the village green from Jane's office. Jane went there every morning for her muffin and coffee, and often lately she'd been going there for lunch as well. Terribly fond of Ginny, Jane wanted her friend to find happiness and knew she wouldn't find it with Rob. So when the time seemed right, Jane planned to delicately broach to Ginny the idea of her and Rob separating, ceasing to live together. From there, they could end their relationship, and Ginny would be psychologically available to other men, men who would appreciate her, Jane had it all figured out, the perfect plan. Unfortunately, so far the perfect time had not presented itself for Jane to share this plan with Ginny. "Oh, pooh," Ginny exclaimed, almost as if reading Jane's thoughts. Poor Ginny had the colored strands of yarn in more of a tangle than before. "Ginny, darling," Jane said gently, "why don't you just cut them and weave them into the back?" "Because," Ginny replied, slamming the half-sweater into her lap, "that's not how it's supposed to be done. You told me yourself that I should carry over the yarns that aren't in use, and then pick them again when I need them." Jane opened her mouth to speak, then closed it. Ginny was clearly in no mood to be reasoned with. But old Doris, seated on the matching sofa directly across from Jane and Ginny's, did not sense Ginny's mood. Or if she did, she didn't care about it. She had lowered her own knitting, a magnificent magenta shawl she was making for a woman she had befriended at the senior center, where she volunteered 2 days a week. "Oh, Ginny, for pity's sake," she said, her wrinkled face growing even more wrinkled in an exasperated frown. "I've never seen such stubbornness. Give it up. You work at that sweater the way you work at Rob, and you should give him up, too." Jane, shocked, looked sharply from Doris to Ginny, who just gaped at the older woman. Tears appeared in Ginny's eyes. "Doris Conway," Rhoda, in her chair at one end of the grouping, smiled a polite smile, clearly trying to keep things light or bring them back to their former lightness. "You do speak your mind, don't you?" The ever unflappable Doris turned her attention to Rhoda. "You, of all people, should agree with me. Wasting all those years with that dentist." Rhoda, who had been keeping the group up to date on the throes of her divorce from the philandering David, abruptly lost her smile. "I'm going to try to keep my temper, Doris, because you always have a big mouth. But I'll thank you not to decide for me that my years with David were wasted. I think that's something for me to decide, thank you. I do, after all, have 2 beautiful children to show for those years." Doris shrugged, though whether it was in concession, Jane couldn't be sure. Jane noticed that quiet little Penny Powell, seated only a few feet from Rhoda, was knitting furiously, eyes downcast, her neck-length brown hair shielding much of her face, like a curtain. Everyone knew that Penny let her husband, Alan, a chauvinist of the classic kind, walk all over her. For example, the reason Penny came to these meetings less often than anyone else was that if Alan suddenly announced he was going out with his buddies, Penny meekly agreed to stay home and take care of 1-year-old Rebecca. But anyone who knew Penny knew nothing would ever change, unless Alan changed it. An uncomfortable silence had descended. At the head of the group, in her customary armchair, bird-faced Louise sat like a statue, only her eyes moving, as if judging the temperament of each club member in turn. Jane realized that Louise, though uninvolved in the conversation, was more upset than any of them. Poor Louise, so repressed, hated conflict of any sort. And Hydrangea House was, after all, hers. Well, hers and Ernie's. It suddenly occurred to Jane that one day Louise, weary of conflict like this, might someday decide to stop hosting the club's every other Tuesday meetings in this beautiful old inn. That would be a shame. "Louise," Jane said, breaking the silence. "Yes?" Louise burst out, as if startled. Jane laughed. "Sorry, I've been meaning to ask you. I'd like to have a little birthday party for Nick. He's turning 10 next Sunday. Our backyard is so narrow and steep, but I was thinking the inn's backyard would be perfect. I'll pay you, of course. Do you think I could have the party here? I'm thinking there will be about 15 kids from Nick's class and maybe 10 adults." Jane looked around the group. "You're all invited, of course." Louise was smiling, obviously relieved at the subject change. "Of course, Jane, that would be lovely, but I wouldn't dream of letting you pay me. What day were you thinking? We have been very busy lately." The inn often hosted weddings, corporate parties, and other such events. "How about this Sunday?" Jane asked. "That's his birthday." Louise murmured, surprised. "Today's Tuesday. Not much notice." "I know. I'm ashamed to say I've been so busy with work I haven't taken a minute to think this through till now." Louise thought for a moment. "That will work out fine. I'll tell Ernie. We'll set up one of the long tables for the kids and another for the adults. What kind of food were you thinking?" "Nothing fancy. I'll pick up some pizzas from Giorgio's and a birthday cake from Calandra's.
Calandra's, in nearby Fairfield on Route 46, made elaborate and delicious cakes and pastries.
Lovely, Louise said. We'll work out the rest of the details.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?